Our guest on The Year That Made Me today was the federal member for the seat of Leichhardt in far north Queensland from 1996 until 2025, with a gap of 3 years between 2010 and 2013. Warren Entsch has also been a railway porter, an aircraft engineer, a crocodile catcher, a bull catcher, and a farmer, and quite a few other things as well. Warren Entsch, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Pleasure to be here.
Firstly, could you tell us where you were born and about the family that you grew up in?
Born in Bibinda, but at a very young age, probably about 6 months or so, I went to Mareeba. My dad, his entire working life was with the Queensland Railways, starting as an engine cleaner, ending up as a fireman, and then on to being one of the most senior drivers there, so his entire working life. So I grew up there and effectively for most of the time in Housing Commission home. I was the eldest of four kids, and while I didn't mind school, I did quite well at it. Mareeba State School for most of it, with a small gap. When my dad was classified as a driver, we went to Cloncurry for about 12 months, 18 months when I was about 11. And at that point, my mum contracted tuberculosis. And so that was a great disruption. We had to come back onto the coast. Mum ended up in the Cairns thoracic ward for 12 months for treatment for TB. I was the only one that was old enough to be able to visit her. So I stayed with my grandparents in Cairns, and my three younger siblings went down to Goondi near Innisfail and stayed with an uncle and aunt down there for that time. It was quite disruptive. But then there, I spent that time in the Cairns High. It was my early years in Cairns High. But then I went up back to Mareeba. I was in year 10. I think I was just 14 when I finished.
Yeah. So because you did all right at school, but you left at the age of 14 and started doing that wide variety of jobs.
And I say, my mum gave me, I wanted to be a vet.
Right.
And I did an academic course and I've done quite well. But I knew there was no way I could afford it. There was no such thing as HECS in those days. And for me to be a vet, they had to send me to Brisbane. I had to get accommodation, I had to pay for university. We just couldn't do it. But my mum used to say to me, "Moy, what you've got to do is you've got to get a job in the government. They'll look after you for life. Get a job in the railway like your father." And that's why I ended up getting a job as a lad porter, a toilet cleaner, effectively.
Yeah, right.
Rimmer Station. It only lasted 6 months.
And then when you went into politics, you got the one job in government where they don't keep you for life.
Absolutely. You've got to reapply every 3 years.
So tell us about some of the different jobs that you did, and I suppose what you took from them, working out where you were going to go in life, Warren.
Well, what was fortunate, I had a pretty good academic course, you know, history, French, geography, maths one, maths two, science, physics, and English. So I was then offered a job with the Bank of New South Wales. And so I started working with them in 1966. Then I left there, and because I was offered a job with the State Government Insurance Office in Cairns. I took that job up. I was there for nearly three years, and I got called up for national service. But I'd already applied for and had been accepted into the Air Force, and so I flew down to Adelaide to start my recruits. I was down there for 2 weeks, and suddenly I go back to my quarters, and there's two burly military policemen standing there, fully armed, arresting me. And they marched me off to the commanding officer's office, and I'm saying, "What the hell have I done?" You know, I thought I was quite compliant. Anyway, he said that he roared at me, told me that there was a warrant out for my arrest. I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You haven't reported for national service." And I said, "But I'm in the military. I'm here." He said, "But you didn't report." And I said, "Well, I assumed they just talked to each other." Well, he roared at me and he said, "First lesson in this service, never, ever assume." Cost me 2 weeks cleaning pans in the mess as punishment for my wrong assumption.
Yeah. So how did you get involved in representative politics, Warren?
Well, it was with Native Title that really stirred me up. It was very, very divisive what was happening up in Cape York with the Native Title, with the Whig Native Title. And we really didn't know, as Cape York residents and pastoralists, we really didn't know where to go with it. And we didn't know what it really meant, but it was very, very divisive. So I extended an invitation to the then member for Leichhardt, Peter Dodd, one termer, I might add, and the state member, Steve Brettauer. We invited them to a meeting in Cowan, and we met under a big shed. And there was about 60 of us, I guess. And we started to explain that we were very concerned about the uncertainty of it and impacts it was having on the community. And he obviously made assumptions that were not correct. And he challenged me to a wager, a month of his parliamentary salary, against anything I wanted to put up, that the judges would come down and determine in support of the pastoralists, of the graziers. And it really infuriated me. And I went off and I said, you know, a month of your piddling salary against our future, you've got to be joking. I then reminded him that the issues that we had up there, they were not black and white issues. And he misread the room because there was a lot of black faces in there as well. The problem was that you, with this native title and the uncertainty of it, there was a whole lot of newly minted anthropologists coming out of universities, going up into these Cape York communities, ingratiating himself with one of the families or another, and then giving them a justification as to why their native title rights were greater than their next door neighbours. And so there was a lot of conflict within the traditional owner groups themselves. It wasn't about black and white. It was, and that's where it was. Anyway, I let fly, and as did a number of others, and they packed up and jumped on their light aircraft and disappeared. And after they went, I was saying to them, what do we do? How do we get some message on this? And so during the break, I went down, we sat down back up against a corrugated iron outside toilet block, and we penciled a set of principles. We're trying to get our principles on how we lived up there and what we felt needed to be included. And it was about respect and a range of other things. And when we finished it, I put a motion up, and the meeting itself endorsed it. And then we said, how do we get this to the politicians? And so it was agreed that we would contact John Purcell, who was the president of the Cattlemen's Union down south, and ask him if he knew anybody in politics that would be able to help to convey our message. And he did. He agreed to do it. We reconvened a month or two later, a meeting in Musgrave, and Rick Barley turned up with his mate, Noel Pearson. And we presented this to Rick, and which we really appreciated, and he took it out and about what we're wanting to do. That document that we'd done there, leaning up against the toilet, 2 years later, won an a national reconciliation award. It was called the Cape York Heads of Agreement. And so that was that. But on that day after that meeting, or that evening, I was staying at the Exchange Hotel in Colton. I was there with an old mate of mine, Billy Jackson, who had Wolverton Station. And we just had our swags out in the back of the pub near the cold room. And I'd had a couple of coldies, too many. And I just said to Billy, what are we going to do to make these buggers listen to us? You know, we're just being totally ignored. Bill threw his arm around my shoulder and he said, Inchie, you want a change of attitude, you've got to change the bloody government. And that's what set me on when I came back to Olive Isle a couple of weeks later, taking cattle down, picked that stuff up at Mount Carbine Roadhouse, made that phone call. And that's when I decided, set me on that road in 1995.
And that's the year you've chosen as the year that made you, Warren. So what was it like for you to join the parliament as a member of the House of Representatives? Do you remember how you felt?
In a word, overwhelmed. I had no idea what I was up for and the journey that was ahead of me. And I can remember when Anthony Albanese came in the same time as me, Joe Hockey, Brendan Nelson, you know, a lot of good people. So there was a lot of high profile candidates and Pauline Hanson. But anyway, we were invited down initially just to familiarise ourselves and got a story with the speaker. about what was expected of us, etc. And then we were told that we're going to be introduced to the press Canberra Press Gallery, and they took us out into one of the foyer areas, you know, those beautiful garden areas between the buildings. And of course, a lot of the colleagues that were a little bit more politically savvy were racing forward to make sure that they got onto their favourite reporter. I didn't know any of them, and I felt a little bit overwhelmed. And so I retreated back to under a tree while seeing this whole mass getting together. And without even thinking, I put my hand in my pocket. I had to wear a suit. Took out my tin of log cabin tobacco. I opened it up, took some tobacco out, rolled it in my hand, roll it up, get a cigarette paper out, roll it, put it in, and I light a cigarette. And just sitting there reflecting on what was happening around me. Next thing, this character comes over to me and he says, "You're Warren Entsch." "Yes, I'm Warren Entsch." And he says to me, "I've been watching you over there." He said, "Don't change." He said, "Stay true to yourself because you stand out from all the rest."
And who was that?
Laurie Oakes.
There you go.
I got to know Laurie over time. I used to, when I was walking into work, I'd see him. He was working his red cattle dog, or whether walking his red cattle dog, or whether the red cattle dog was walking him. But I've become quite very fond of Laurie over time. But that was the advice he gave me on that day, and I never forget it.
Warren, when did marriage equality as an issue first come to your attention, and when were you converted to it as a cause?
Initially, I really wasn't that, like, wedded to marriage equality. I mean, I was a little bit naive as well. What I found out early in the piece when I was there, I had a young naval officer come into my office from HMAS Cairns. This is in the very early stages of my office. And he was putting a complaint about the fact that he'd just been posted a promotion out of Cairns, and Navy was paying for his jet ski, his motor car, all his personal effects and that to go to his new posting, and his budgerigar and his dog. That they would not pay for his partner of many years, who was living with him in America, in Cairns, wouldn't partner on the basis that I was same sex. Now, I thought, this is bullshit. It just doesn't make sense. So I went to the then Minister for Defence, Robert Hill, and I explained it to Robert. He agreed with me, and he changed the legislation. He changed the rules there so that he could take his partner. And I thought I'd fixed all those problems and relation to gay issues. But I started to do some digging, and I got a whole lot of stuff there in relation to financial. And so that I started the campaign initially on the discrimination side of it, both financial and legal. And over the early years there, starting to put stuff, getting a lot more information, and information is very, very powerful. But anyway, at that same time, that I was still getting a bit of pressure there from some within the gay movement saying to me, "You want to do marriage?" And I kept saying, "No, let's focus on one thing at a time." But there was a lot of pressure. And so eventually I thought, "Oh, well, I'll do a marriage civil union," which I thought, well, that'll help address that while I focus on the discrimination. Anyway, it was David Scammell from New South Wales and Rodney Croom. Said, "No way in the world, don't devalue us by doing that." And so I listened to them. I still have that civil union bill sitting in my files, but I never, ever put it up. And when I came back in 2010, both Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott had both committed in 2010 not to push the marriage button. And I thought, this is a problem. But my very dear friend, Graham Perrett, He was in a similar situation. So we made an agreement that we would approach our respective leaders, and as I did with Tony, and just said, "Look, mate, I'm going to honour your commitment here, but don't do it at the next election." I said, "If you lock in this same commitment in 2013, I'll go against you." And to Tony's credit, he didn't. He didn't lock it in, and I was able to pursue it. But in the meantime, I was the chief opposition whip. And so talking to Graham, I said, "Mate, we've got to do something here that we don't get, because our leader's jammed." And he agreed with me. And so we established the Parliamentary Friendship Group for the LGBTIQ community in 2010. Now, that's the first one in the world. I think it probably still is one of the only ones in the world. And Sarah Hanson-Young came in as the third co-chair of that Parliamentary Friendship Group. And so we were able to deal with quite a lot of stuff in that area in relation to blockers and puberty blockers and a range of other things, plus also deal with the aged care stuff. And then in 2013, we started in earnest. And I said to Tony at the time, after the election, I said, I'm not gonna hit you up on this one for the first 12 months. I said, but I've got to do it before the last 12 months. I don't want to do it right at the end. I said, we've got to fit it in. And this is where I actually brought it in 2000. I moved the legislation in 2015, I think. And it was interesting because there was a big Sunday full-page exposure at one stage on me, which really made me very angry. And my mate Christopher Pine played a role in it, in that he shared with one of the national journos bits of a story that I shared about him when I was bull catching up in the Gulf, about a person that went for a sex change. But anyway, the headline was, you know, MP says why he supports the gays. And it starts off fiercely heterosexual, far north Queensland, crocodile farming, wild bull catching liberal, and he supports the gay community. And then it had some of this story to it, you know. And I was travelling down to Canberra on that Sunday back for another parliamentary sitting. And as I always did on a Sunday, I'd always go into my office in Canberra, get in there around about 6-7 o'clock and have a look and see what emails were there, if they're ready for work on Monday. And I opened it up and the emails literally fell in. There was hundreds of them. And they were all in response to this article. Interestingly, they were not from the gay community. They were from friends and relatives of people that were gay. And they were saying, starting with, if far north Queensland, crocodile farming, wild bull catching, liberal, fiercely heterosexual far north Queensland is prepared to stand up for my gay family member or friend, we want to come out too. And that's when I realised that I was probably the first person that was not pigeonholed and identified as openly gay, that was arguing very strong in a national sense for marriage equality, etc.
Was that your proudest moment as a parliamentarian, the passage of the Marriage Equality Bill?
It made a big difference, yes, of course. When I stop and think about it, the numbers of people that were impacted by this, I mean, I was always being accused of all sorts of things, and my sexuality was always questioned because of what I was doing. You know, people make all sorts of assumptions as to my sexuality, which really didn't worry me. And in fact, I probably deliberately provoked it, because whenever doing interviews, inevitably, whether they were national or international interviews, inevitably the question would be asked, "Oh, by the way, Mr. Hinch, are you gay?" And I used to take great delight in saying, I'm quite comfortable in you identifying me any way you choose. The only thing I ask of you is don't be offensive, because my sexuality's got absolutely nothing to do with my advocacy. This is about being fair and doing the right thing.
Warren, how are you finding life after politics?
Warren, I keep reminding people that I, you know, after 30-odd years in the political sphere, and not out there making political commentary. I've retired from politics, but I have a farm up on the Atherton Tablelands where I'm about a few weeks short of finishing a second house there for my son, my oldest son, so he can take responsibility. Then he can start looking after the farm. If he wants an inheritance, he's going to have to work for it. I live with my youngest son in Cairns, and It's been a wonderful experience. I've been living with him there for 3 years. But I'm very actively involved in other things. I'm very heavily involved with mental health. I was the only parliamentarian that was the independent chair of the Headspace Consortium. I've done that for probably 10 years. They've asked me to stay on in there, so I continue as that independent role with the. And that's one of the bookends of mental health, early intervention from 12 to 25. I also was involved in establishing what we call the Junction Clubhouse, which is the other end of the other book ended, the other end, when people come out of intensive mental health care, they don't go into, they don't just have to go into their, because there are no institutions anymore. So they don't go back into their home and disappear in a cave or end up on the streets or in prisons. This gives them a safe space where they can come and hang out and reevaluate and end up back into community. They asked me to go on the board there, and I've been actively involved in working with that. So that's the two bookends of mental health. Years ago, a couple of dear friends of mine in Bungendore in New South Wales, we've established the National Threatened Species Institute. And there is where we are captive breeding. Number of different native species, threatened species. There's the New Holland mouse and the Smoky mouse, where we're breeding them very successfully and releasing them back into national parks. We've got the largest population of orange-bellied parrots and breeding them and involved in that program of releasing them back into Tasmania. We've also got the only eastern ground parrots in captivity in the world. Had them now for a couple of years. We got a permit to trap them out of the national park. We have a permit to take 12. We've taken 5. We haven't lost a bird. They are absolutely thriving. We've built purpose-built aviaries for them. And we'll now take the other 7 at some stage to get genetic diversity. Been very successful. So that's another thing that I've been doing. I've been invited to go over to the Canary Islands, would you believe, at my expense, by the way, in September. For the International Parrot Conference, which I'll go over there with the National Threatened Species Institute, but that's every 4 years, so I'm looking forward to that. And one other thing I'm on, I've got to mention this. I've been involved in the TB Global TB Caucus for since we established in 2014. I'm now the vice president of the Global TB Caucus, and I'm working within my own area here. And in fact, I have recently come back from Papua New Guinea after re-establishing the caucus in Papua New Guinea. I'm going over again on the 25th, compliments of Air New Guinea, to work with the Prime Minister, with James Moapi and his health minister and other parliamentarians, as we're looking at rolling out a program for tuberculosis, dealing with one of the highest incidences of tuberculosis in the world we see in Papua New Guinea. So I'm keeping pretty, well, not busy enough because it's intermittent, but nevertheless, you know, annoying a lot of very good friends of mine, heading out for having dinner with them every so often and what have you, but looking for course to do. But anyway, I'm enjoying it.
And Warren, we always finish the year that made me with a piece of music. You get to choose. What have you chosen for us and why?
Classic, mate. Classic stuff. Willie Nelson, Mamas Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys.
Warren Ench, thank you once again.
Thank you very much indeed.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.